I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're delighting in the creepy, the spooky, the skin-crawling aspects of food history and culture.
Give yourself over to man's more hedonistic tendencies, and you wouldn't be making it to the great beyond. The Sin Eater's job was to ensure that you did.
In modern horror, audiences have been captivated by the isolation, mystery, and terror of rural life.
And so one of these preparations is actually taking oak bark, stuffing it into a cow skull, and burying that cow skull in a creek for a year.
I would argue that their evil went hand in hand with their marketing strategy. I'm not saying they had an excuse, but in order to make bananas work, they were deluded. They had to do these terrible things.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I'm so excited to welcome to the studio none other but Paul Willis. Paul is a fourth-generation hog farmer in Iowa, and he is, of course, the founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company. Paul, thank you for joining me today.
I'm happy to be here.
All the way from Iowa.
Yes.
Just for this interview.
Yeah, I just got up from the farm, came here. Here I am.
Oh, I was so excited to have you. Okay, so let's jump right in. I've got about a million questions for you, of course. Can you start with giving us an overview of the company? Because you are the founder specifically of the pork company, but Nyman has much more than just pork, right?
Beef and lamb, mm-hmm. In addition to pork. So I was raising a substantial number of pasture-raised pigs, and probably in the 80s, even into the 90s, we had something that came to be known as factory farming, CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, started moving into the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. We were told we should get bigger or get out. And we were being squeezed in the marketplace, and this was about the time I started looking for a market. And it kind of goes back to the fact that I met a woman in a store in California buying an organic chicken, and she was paying about three times the price of a commodity chicken. And I asked her why. She said, well, it tastes better.
There you go.
And, you know, I like the way it's raised and the way it's treated. And I'm thinking, you know, if you have free-range chicken, why shouldn't you have free-range pigs? So I looked around for actually a number of years. There were people that wanted to buy a pork chop or a loin or this and that, but I wasn't raising pork chops. I was raising pigs. And so eventually, through a friend of mine, I met Bill Nyman in San Francisco, and he understood immediately what this was about, that I was raising a substantial number of animals, and that I was looking for a market. And he was at this time had started a meat company called Nyman Shell. And excuse me. Anyway, we hit it off, and I went back to Iowa, and I sent some samples just out of the freezer, mm-hmm. and places that went to like. Chapinese, Alice Waters restaurant, some of those type of upscale restaurants that you know, they tried the product and they were very enthused about the eating quality. And then, of course, what I was doing was, it hadn't been emphasized so much that animal welfare was a credential that you wanted to have on your, you know, what it was you were doing, because it in the past it had been, you know, kind of commonplace. It was something that was disappearing.
Yeah, it's
really.
It's how animals used to be raised.
Right. It was, so it we were kind of like changing food by not changing food.
Yeah. So how did the process kind of work with the combining of the companies?
Okay, you're jumping ahead.
I have a tendency to do that.
around 20 years.
Oh, I met with you and with Bill.
Oh.
Yeah, originally. Yeah, we're going to get to the other one. Yeah.
Okay, so, we were excited about it. I had to figure out how does it work.
Mm-hmm.
Bill said, the pork needs to be here 5:30 Monday morning. How does that happen? How does a live animal get from your farm in Iowa to San Francisco? And so I contacted a packing plant, and I said, I had customers that were interested in the West Coast that wanted pork from my farm. Would they help me out? And we figure out how to do the custom processing and the logistics, how to get it there. And so it was just doing your homework and figuring out what day did the animals have to be there. And, you know, the animals were slaughtered, and then the carcasses hang and they have to be chilled. And then the breaking takes place, cutting them into primal cuts,
mm-hmm.
has to get on a truck, and it takes a couple days to get to the West Coast. And we did it the first time in February of 95.
Okay.
And I shipped 30 pigs. That was the beginning.
Wow. 30 pigs.
30 pigs,
and
yeah.
What are those numbers like today?
Well, just to fill in the middle a little bit, I could see that I needed more farmers besides myself, and I was involved in writing the protocol, how the animals should be raised, which is they're commonly used for various welfare organizations that third-party auditing and this kind of thing. It's very similar to what's being used today. But anyway, little by little, we added more farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And if we paid a premium price to our farmers, and if they were meeting the criteria. Also, about 2002, we went to a no antibiotic ever.
Wow.
Program, which is, you hear a lot about that today, but we were
way ahead of that.
Way ahead.
Yeah.
And so today we have about 600 hog farmers, and then we also have beef people raising beef on mm-hmm. ranches, and then we have some people raising lamb. So there's, in the Nyman Ranch Network, there's about 760 farmers and ranchers today.
Okay. And what percentage of those, where is the breakdown in terms of product? So is it about 50-50-ish between beef and pork?
Yes. Between the beef and the pork. Of course, a beef is a bigger animal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the pounds and the dollars and so on, it falls in there somewhere.
Okay.
The lamb is a small part of the business.
Okay. And so you said, there's a couple things that you brought up. The first is the animal welfare standards. So did you craft those yourself when looking for other farmers to join your network, or is that something you contributed to more broadly from a policy perspective?
I actually met Diane Halverson, who was working for the Animal Welfare Institute,
mm-hmm.
and they had attempted to have to write some standards and have that part of a process, and they were really kind of unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing this out of Minnesota, but maybe the market or the grocery stores they were working with weren't ready for it at the time, but. She'd already been involved in crafting the, kind of the outline for what the animal welfare should look like. And my attitude was, come on down to the farm, take a look, see what I'm doing. If I'm not doing it right, let's get it right.
Mm-hmm. And so these were practices you already had been using.
On my farm, it was almost a perfect fit because I was raising pasture raised outdoor pigs with bedding, lots of space.
What's lots of space mean?
Most of the pigs are raised out on a 20-acre field.
Okay, that's a lot of space.
I mean, they're free range, running. I'm raising like 3,000 pigs a year.
Okay.
We had barns and different setups for different times of the year, but they all included bedding and or free range pasture.
Okay, and no antibiotics.
That came. We didn't really have a policy on that initially, but it was kind of no subtherapeutic antibiotics. What we found was the customer could not understand that at all.
Right.
And we just decided to go to no antibiotics ever. Mm-hmm. At that time, feed companies that sold baby pig feed all had antibiotics in their feed. You had to special order feed without antibiotics because it was so pervasive in the entire food chain.
In 2002?
Yeah.
Wow. That is crazy.
Well, it was, and you had to pay more.
Sure. Wow.
To get feed without antibiotics.
That is something. Yeah.
So when we started to do that and started to demand that, that really changed the whole dynamics of the, especially some of the smaller feed companies, because if they wanted to be, supplying some of our farmers, they had to. They had to adhere to these standards.
Yeah, they changed their standards.
Yeah.
Just a question on animal welfare. Do you, and this has been, I think, I want to ask you about organic in a minute, but if an animal is sick, I guess what's the justification for no antibiotics ever if an animal gets sick? Like, is it more humane to treat them or?
We advocate treating an animal with antibiotics if you need to. Mm-hmm. We just can't buy it under our brand.
Okay.
It has to be marketed a different way.
Okay.
And identified with an ear tag or something, so they don't get mixed up. What we've also found out is there are really lots of other ways to handle
illness,
health problems that you might have. Mm-hmm. First of all, you might want to do some testing and find out if there's any some diagnostic work to find out if you have a particular problem. Maybe there's something you can be vaccinating for,
right,
which is an immunity, not an antibiotic. And we used to get flu and pneumonia in the fall quite often when the change of weather would happen, And what we found is that if you put some expectorant and some aspirin in the water, it worked just as well as if you had the antibiotic.
Well, antibiotics don't really work for flus anyways, right?
Well, bacterial pneumonia, yes.
Yeah, this is bacterial, yes.
You get flu, and then it would turn into pneumonia.
Oh, okay, yes.
So, yes, but the expectorant and the aspirin, the animal would feel better. They wouldn't have a fever, so they'd get up and eat and drink and everything, and they would... Using apple cider vinegar in the feed to change the pH of the feed can help with some of the gut problems.
Huh.
So we've done quite a few things to look into more of the alternative methods of handling some of these situations other than just dumping antibiotics at the animals.
Which is way healthier. So your animals are, it seems like pretty close to being raised organically, but... They're not because the feed is not organic, right?
The feed, to be certified organic, you'd have to feed all organically certified feed. Mm-hmm. So on my farm, for example, we do raise some organic feed, but that's sold directly and it goes into the human food chain.
Okay.
So it brings about three times the money compared to commodity crops. And... So, about 60 to 80% of the cost of raising a pig is feed. And so you...
I did not know that.
You increase 300% the cost of feed.
Yeah.
It makes a pretty big difference of what you need in the marketplace.
Right.
And some people might want like an organic pork chop or a certain cut. But, as I said before, the animal... you have to market all of it.
You got
to
use all
of it. So
you
have to have a premium price for everything to make it work.
Right. So people don't necessarily want an organic...
Ears.
Yeah, I could see there not being as high of a demand for that. But, you know, we live in a world where people forget that, I think, like, pork chop comes from a pork and it's attached to an entire animal, right? There's very...
Yeah, it comes from the off the back of the animal.
Yeah, I think that people... I think maybe they're, you know, they don't... I think it's just not a top of mind. It's an entire animal this came from. Okay, so I want to talk for a minute about the farmers that you work with. Can you just kind of give us some general information about what your farmers
sure.
look like?
Yeah. Our farmers own and take care of their livestock. And if they meet our animal welfare criteria and it's raised with no antibiotics,
mm-hmm.
It's a vegetarian diet, and if they meet the standards, we pay a premium price. And we also do... you know, we have a veterinarian on staff. If they have problems, they can help them.
Quick question. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you said vegetarian diet. Is that typical for raising pork? I mean, certainly.
Well, in
I
the past, oftentimes meat and bone meal, even fish meal, and these
right.
type of things were used in hog feed.
Right.
And, there's different reasons not to use those. Mad cow disease was
a problem.
A big scare. it was seemed to be coming from consuming animals that were
the same
the brain yeah. and the spinal cord and so on from beef. And it was just something that we wanted to do that with pork as well. We didn't think it was appropriate to be feeding parts of other animals too, you know, even though we know that a pig eats lots of things, they are omnivores.
Right. Yes, truly. But I had interviewed a woman who works at the ASPCA, for instance, and runs their farm animal welfare program. And she was mm-hmm. explaining how, like, vegetarian fed chickens, for instance, isn't ideal for chickens because they eat, like, you know, worms and bugs and all these other kind
yeah.
of things, like, in the field and nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had a question kind of about how that applies to your animals.
It's primarily driven by the mad cow disease.
Yeah. I mean, different kinds of animals, I would say.
You know,
meat.
I mean, I have my own chickens and I let them out in the morning. The first thing, they run out and they eat as many worms as they can find, especially after a rainy day.
Yeah.
Or rainy night. And you know, I'm well aware of that. But anyway, that's the policy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the animal protein was from tankage. It was processed.
It's not ideal.
Meat and bone meal, things like this that came from animals, or it's a surplus that comes out of the packing plant.
Yeah.
And it's ground up and it's cooked and prepared and everything. It should be... It shouldn't be carrying any diseases or anything like that, but you know,
just want to be safe.
Precautionary.
And yeah. Okay. So that makes total sense in terms of the definition and the standard. So I interrupted you before. You said no use of antibiotics, vegetarian fed. What are the other sort of standards that your farmers that you work with have to meet in order to work with them?
Well, the standards sort of relate to allowing the pigs, let's talk about the pigs,
mm-hmm.
to exhibit their natural behavior. So, for example, when a sow is about to give birth, they build a nest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're almost hardwired to do this. Now, if they're living on a concrete floor...
It's hard to do that.
It's hard to do this, pretty hard to build a nest out of concrete.
Yeah.
I've actually seen sows try to get a hold of some garden hose and build a nest.
Oh, that like breaks
so,
my heart.
Yeah. So we require the sows to have straw,
mm-hmm.
Whether they're in a building or they're out in the field, and you know, and then bedding, and then we have space requirements. We do have barns and hoop buildings and deep bedded systems and everything, but they're space requirements depending on the size of the animals.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not overcrowded.
That's a good thing. That's
yeah.
Definitely not how it is raised in an industrial setting.
Right. We don't clip teeth. We don't. You probably don't know this, but baby pigs are often have their teeth clipped when they're born.
What do you mean by clipped?
They clip the teeth off. They're like little pointed teeth.
Yeah.
They clip the tip off the teeth, so they don't fight each other and scar each other up on the nose quite so much. But we really found that wasn't necessary, so we just don't do that. We don't clip tails. All the pigs that are in confinement buildings have their tails docked.
Why?
Well, they chew each other's tails. Ugh. Because of the...
Because they're like in such an unnatural
environment. Well, they're in a crowded situation and there's stress.
Wow. Okay.
So the welfare criteria we have is to reduce stress, and I mean this involves whether you're whatever you're doing on your farm or the trucking or anything, you want to reduce stress at all.
Mm-hmm.
At all points, if you can. That's why we worked with Temple Grandin as well, you know, and she's pointed out things that if you're loading pigs, for example, if there's a beam of light shining in the chute or something,
mm-hmm.
we might not even notice that, but the animal notices that, and that would be frightening.
Right. Can you just give us can you tell us who Temple Grandin is?
Well, Temple Grandin is an animal science person from Colorado State. There was a movie made about her. She's autistic herself and has a very unique way of understanding how animals think and behave.
Mm-hmm.
And she's developed all kinds of different handling systems and really some very good tips about working with your animals. Even people that have raised animals for a long time,
yeah.
Almost a lifetime, can learn things from her.
Didn't she develop like the process by which many animals are killed, even in like CAFO environments, that is like the most humane for them?
She's worked with all kinds of animal production systems. Yeah,
that is a very diplomatic way of saying yeah. I mean, but I think that her work was ultimately is very important because it's mm-hmm. you know, it's still end
she's
of life.
She's a big fan of ours, by the way.
Yes, I'm sure. I'm sure. I'm sure you're. Yes, that makes sense. So you make the transportation process to, you know, much more calming for the animals.
Yeah, you end up bedding, make sure the truck isn't cold or hot or, you know,
yeah.
Overcrowded, things like that.
So these farmers that you decide to do you contract with these farmers?
Yeah, we have all kinds of different arrangements. We have a number of Amish farmers, probably a third of our farmers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do contracts. They do agreements.
Okay.
Kind of a handshake kind of deal.
Really? Okay.
But we do that.
So
they get the same kind of deal, but
yeah. I mean, I would assume that, you know, it might be more beneficial for the producer to have some sort of a contract, but if an agreement works for them,
well,
and for you, if you're counting on their supply.
It's a verbal contract, I guess you'd say anyway,
yeah.
You know, but we have different arrangements for people that raise pigs all year round because, you know, the customer doesn't understand you can, you know, they want product year round, not just in the spring and the fall.
Yeah, they want lemons in the yeah. Northeast in February.
So, it's based on the price of the cost of production plus a value on your labor and your investment, things like this. Last year, and I have to tell you right from the beginning, my goal was to distance myself from the commodity world as far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wanted an animal welfare certification, no antibiotics, and be forward thinking on these issues. But it was important that we establish a good price for our farmers. They're not raising huge volumes, so they actually need to make more per pig.
Mm-hmm.
And so this last year with tariffs and all these kind of things that affected the commodity market quite a bit.
Yeah.
We were paying almost 100% premium to our farmers.
Wow.
About twice as much.
Wow. That must have been...
They're very happy about that.
They were, yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. But that had to affect the bottom line of the business.
Well, we always do that.
You always...
It just, yeah. It was more dramatic because the tariffs took the commodity market down.
Yeah.
So I wanted to add something. You said, talk a little bit about the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Our farmers average 43 years of age.
That's young.
Young. Farmers in general, right now, about 59 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And we just dropped from 48 to 43.
Going in the right direction.
So we're going the right direction. We have a lot of incentives.
Yeah, how do you do that? I mean...
We even, this past year, we gave away breeding stock to new and beginning farmers.
Yeah.
About $300,000 worth of breeding stock.
Wow. And how do you deal with that with land, too? Do you...
Yeah, we...
Because your farmers
Nyman
own them.
Ranch, I mean, they have to have a base someplace,
mm-hmm.
a relative or a friend or something, or rent land or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it, many people have jobs other places. They raise a few pigs on the side.
Mm-hmm.
But there are many cases where raising pigs becomes a very substantial part of a diversified farm. Pretty good, income flow.
Yeah.
So depending on the size, you know.
Yeah. So you work with younger farmers and you incentivize more farmers to get in the business.
Well, as you can see, the average age of farmers is
was it like 50?
59.
Yeah.
So the reality is you need new people getting into this. And the other thing is that it shows that what we have to offer by, guaranteed price,
mm-hmm.
and the way we raise our livestock is attractive to younger people. And they can get into this as just an enterprise. And I mean, almost all their farms they do a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
They probably raise some crops. They might be raising beef and pork, or maybe even lamb, or, so...
That is very impressive and much needed, because the majority of our farmers are reaching retirement age. So
yeah,
it'd be really great if we could continue to have food.
we're proud of that. And like I said, we do a lot of things. We have a scholarship program for the these are the young people that are the children of our farmers, and these are the people. Yeah, they probably are going to go to college someplace, but their goal is to come back to the farm, and so we've had a lot of customers that have helped raise money for the scholarship program. Last year we had 39 people apply, and we gave out scholarships of, I think it was $130,000.
Wow. Where are your farmers located, by and large? Are they
Okay, so the hog farmers are primarily in the upper Midwest, where the Corn Belt is, but they go all the way east as far as Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Iowa, and all the surrounding states. And then the beef tends to be a little bit farther west, the Dakotas, Nebraska. There's some in Iowa, Missouri, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
There's an outlier in Oregon. And then the lamb is primarily raised in California.
Lamb sounds really good to me right now.
It's the Nyman lamb, if you ever get a chance to...
To taste it?
To taste it, it's absolutely the best.
Well, where could you find that, for instance? Because, I mean, and one of my questions was, where do you sell most of your products? Is it to, is it to retail, like grocery stores? Or, I mean, Nyman was a big supplier for Chipotle at one time, right?
Yeah, we are.
You still are, yeah.
Today. Yeah, Chipotle, Panera, those are, those kind of customers. But retail... Mm-hmm. A number of grocery stores. I'm sure there are probably some right here in Brooklyn that carry different...
Yeah, definitely.
the products. We also have a wide web of food distributors that work with food service. DeBraga in whether or not New Jersey, but they're they're a major supplier to restaurants in the New York metro area. And, you know, so they have their own salespeople. We work with them, and that's how the product gets to restaurants. And you'll find it on the menu often, you know.
Okay, well, we're going to just actually have to take a really quick commercial break, but we will be back in a minute, so stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th, for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with farmer and founder of Nyman Ranch Pork Company, Paul Willis. One of the, in thinking kind of about the divide, there's a real divide right now between urban and rural America, right? And I'm thinking if you're trying to encourage more younger farmers, I don't know if, you know, and the idea of kind of farmers, like kids, the next generation leaving, you know, going away to school, maybe coming back to work the land. I'm wondering if you've felt that as a farmer yourself more acutely, that like this divide, and how you as a company have maybe worked to address that.
Well, I was telling you about the scholarship program.
Yeah.
And these are this money goes primarily to the family members of existing Nyman Ranch farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And it does tend, especially livestock production of any scale, it does tend to be a generational thing. You know, it's pretty hard. It takes a lot of money and to have some sort of base, maybe you're grandfather and grandmother's farm has some older buildings or something like that you can start with.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few cases where there are people that have been urban people that somehow have ended up in a rural area and become farmers, but it's not common.
Right. And what are some of the challenges, the ongoing challenges? Like, this is a pretty, you can say, a tougher time to be a farmer, certainly a dairy farmer, right? Which you guys are not in that business. But I mean, what are some of the things that you're hearing from your farmers, and are you lobbying on those issues? I'm just kind of curious.
Well, access to money,
capital
is always a challenge. We will go as a company, Nyman Ranch, go to the bank, talk to the banker, so they understand what this is about, if necessary. We've become well you know, more known, and people know this is a real business, you know.
It's, yeah.
You know, that's maintaining the quality and the genetics. We have some small breeding companies that supply breeding stock.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not as numerous as they were at one time.
Really?
Just because...
There's no demand. I don't know.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
I was like, I'm gonna guess.
You know, so...
We like one type of animal these
so
days.
But we do a lot of testing. Every farmer that sells pork every week, we pull samples, and we pay our farmers based on the eating quality, and we're constantly looking for the right genetics that's going to work right in our type of system and mm-hmm. do what we're looking for.
Okay, so you think that the biggest challenge is access to capital?
Access to capital and land.
And land. I read...
Land, buildings, you know, equipment, all of it.
Just everything. All of the inputs required.
Yeah.
So now I want to talk about what I think you thought I meant at the beginning, which is the big announcement for Nyman, in the past few years, which of course was the acquisition by Purdue. Of the company, and was it 2015?
It's 3 years.
Yeah.
16, I believe.
Oh, 16. Okay, so can you tell us what happened there?
Well, since I started working with Bill Nyman in 1995,
mm-hmm.
I've seen at least four different owners, and it's not uncommon for a startup company for this to happen. Somebody starts it up, and then they need more capital, and there's buy-in, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a couple of instances where you just needed that capital to come in, and there was some venture capital that got involved, and they had controlling interest.
VC. There was VC funding for Nyman.
There was ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. For
8 years.
Wow.
And there was an influx, and then there was another influx. They also bought a packing plant, combined all of it together,
okay.
And it ended up being called the Natural Foods Holding Company,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Purdue bought.
Okay.
Which included a packing plant and all of the Nyman Ranch, everything.
Okay. So what
the
was
network
the
network and so forth?
So it was more of a. And there have been four owners since 95, and Mr. Nyman, did he...
The original people, yes, and then he had some partners.
Okay.
It actually started out, it was Nyman Shell.
Oh, okay.
Bill Nyman, Orville Shell.
Yeah.
I just saw a program on Frontline about IT and China and everything.
Uh-huh.
And Orville Shell happens to be an expert on China, and he was a featured person two nights ago.
Wow.
He was a professor at Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
But he long gone from the meat world, you know.
Yeah.
But he wrote a book called Modern Meat way back in the, I think, the 80s or something.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the eye-opener because he didn't know anything about meat or anything, and he wrote about what he saw as he went around the country. And he went to these, you know, big trade shows, and there were selling a lot of antibiotics and food additives and all kinds of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that naturally clean-raised animals, that whole thing was disappearing. There were hormones in poultry and various things, and, I mean, there were some, you know, horrendous cases of... early development in kids and
issues, the complications,
all kinds of things. That anyway, that just
jog your memory.
Eye opener, and so Bill decided he wanted to raise clean raised, beef, and he had even a source of a few pigs. But anyway, then they had to bring some money in because mm-hmm. that started growing. A few other partners. Then the venture capital came in eventually. And then there was another round of that, And then that was not like the third group. And then ultimately Purdue.
And then Purdue. Okay. So what was, I mean, you know, and the company kind of got a little bit of blowback, actually a lot bit, I think, into the when this sort of sale went through. So how did your farmers react to the news?
Well, I've been...
Actually, I'm sorry to cut you off. So basically, just to kind of round that up, I mean, there it was a financial decision that was made by the owners of the company at the time to sell because they wanted to get their investment back. Was that kind
well,
of
they
how
wanted
it works?
To make money.
They wanted to make money.
They
yeah.
did make.
Yeah.
And there was also an investment by Iowa Finance Corporation, which was a state funded. I mean, they owned this packing plant, and a lot of these things were bundled together. Eventually, became Natural Foods Holding.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
I mean, it's even more complicated because
right.
there was a provision where. Where some of the early Nyman farmers had some interest in the packing plant, and because the state required certain farmer buy-in and things like that.
Okay, all right. So complicated. There was a business decision to sell. Purdue was like, "This is a gem." Going to go this way.
Well, yes. They had already purchased Coleman.
Okay.
About 5 years before, and Coleman was raising some pork and also some poultry and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people were well familiar with Nyman Ranch, and they're like, "We should bring Nyman Ranch into this." And so, anyway, what my position as manager of the pork company and the founding hog farmer, and you know, I wanted to maintain the integrity of what we were doing, and I thought that was really important.
Yeah.
And I wanted to stay on with the company to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally felt that was welcome. Mm-hmm. They were glad that I was going to stay on because it lended some continuity to the, I mean, I know all these farmers, right?
Right. You have the relationships.
Yeah.
And I think with farmers, especially of in other industries, like, that's so important.
Yeah, well, it is, and we do have a very it's almost like a family.
Yeah,
you know,
tight knit and
right, and that's continued, and you know, I guess everybody was a bit reluctant at first, you know, but the pledge was, you know, Nyman Ranch, a great company. We're do what you do, you know, keep doing more of it. Maybe we can learn something from you.
Right,
and so you know. Purdue will tell you that they have learned a lot from Nyman Ranch, and we have. I had a board of directors, farmer board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
Purdue now has a whole bunch of farmer councils, animal welfare, and changing the, putting windows in their buildings, and even thinking about a longer growing chicken and various things, and. They've been a kind of a pioneer, a leader in getting antibiotics out of their
their food supply. That's been, they've really led the way on that without a doubt.
That's 100%.
It's impressive. And they also started to do that, like, I mean, they didn't talk about it for a long time, but they started, I went like early 2000s, I think, if not a little sooner. I mean, they've really been on that.
Well, it's been a long journey because even the eggs initially
mm-hmm.
had antibiotics injected into the egg, and they were like part of the, you know, and to figure out how to get all of that out of it, you know.
Took a lot of time.
Yeah, it was unknown technology.
And they did a lot of research, you know, and I think mm-hmm. that I interviewed Maren McKinnon a while ago, who wrote Big Chicken, and she wrote a lot about this, about kind of the steps that they've, mm-hmm. how they've taken the lead in trying to have a more, more responsible kind of practices, I would say.
Yeah.
But they really like... They proved the business case. So not only did they kind of decide to do the right thing, they made sure that it worked from a financial standpoint also for various reasons. So I think that's like a powerful case that other companies can use.
Well, one of the other things is through this animal care, they have a summit,
mm-hmm.
and invited many of the animal welfare groups to come and meet with them, ASPCA, Humane Society,
mm-hmm.
and others. And we're really, everybody was, I think, nervous in the beginning.
Yeah, those two, so, yeah.
But it's turned out to be a great working relationship because people are talking to each other and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're doing things or we're doing things at Nyman Ranch and we do the same thing. And we've had many of these groups come out to, you know, and it's still my attitude. If you don't see something that that looks right, we want to know about it because we want to do it right. It's
right.
Got to be better for the animals, better for the farmers, better for the environment, mm-hmm. better for the customer.
So it hasn't really, it sounds like the acquisition hasn't really changed the operations of the business so much. Is that true?
The way that Nyman Ranch has been changed a little bit is because as a family business, Purdue is willing to take and have a long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so the packing plant has been upgraded, $5 million or something like this. Whereas your venture capital people, they're not going to do that.
Yeah.
So if there's been things that we want to do, they've been,
supportive.
Very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
So access to capital on the business side in that way has been really good.
Mm-hmm. And it's been you. It sounds like you haven't had to. Have you come on under pressure to make changes and cut costs at all?
No, not really, because
it's
they know.
Amazing.
They know. I mean, our goal is to make sure that our farmers stay whole.
Yeah.
And are being paid fairly.
Right.
And it's. I mean, we talk about it all the time, even to the sales and marketing people. It's your responsibility. All these farmers are depending on you,
mm-hmm.
and it's really part of the mainstay of the business.
Right, it's core to what you guys do.
Yeah,
I still imagine that must not be an easy sell at certain points, or certainly not historically. And you led a lot of that work, right? Just trying to drive a value proposition of farming in this responsible way.
Well, the quality really speaks for itself. You know, there's a dramatic difference in the eating experience.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said at Food Tank, even as a meat company, we're saying you shouldn't eat as much meat as you do, but you should eat better meat. You should support the farmers and the system that's better for everybody.
Right, which was one of my questions. It's been a lot of talk about climate change, especially in the past year with a number of reports, and almost all of them, I think all of them, as a number one recommendation for people for what they can do to fight climate change is to significantly reduce the consumption of meat and beef specifically. So given that that's 50% of your portfolio by and large, how have you grappled with that situation?
Well, it's the same thing. The Nyman beef is you know, I'd say almost uncomparable. It's excellent. It comes from smaller ranches. You know, the animals have access to pasture and they're. There's a big contrast to the big feedlots of Western Kansas, and I don't know if you've ever seen them, but there's feedlots as far as the eye can see. There's not a blade of grass out there.
I have not seen that.
Huge contrast to, and where does the waste go? We would call it fertilizer, but when you have it too much in one place, it becomes waste.
Right.
You know, something you're trying to get rid of. So our scale is lends itself to, you know, to be, I would say, not a problem.
Right.
So you have animals walking around the field dropping little piles of fertilizer here and there.
Fertilizer, where there's actually grass. Can you give us a sense of what those numbers look like in terms of the number of industrial feeding operations, like maybe just within Iowa?
Well, okay, so the CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations, is just pigs. Mm-hmm. There's 13,000 in Iowa, as far as we can tell.
Yeah.
And
that's a lot.
There are a lot. They're everywhere, and there's even talk about, we could have a lot more. Now, what comes along with that, we have the most polluted water of any state in the country.
Iowa does?
Iowa.
I did not realize that.
Well, we might be 49th. But it's bad, and it comes primarily from excessive runoff into drainage tile, which gets into your open water system.
Wow.
And, this liquid manure is injected into the ground, and then if you get a big rain event, it gets into the waterway. And or excess application of nitrogen and things like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, down the Mississippi it goes, and then you get the big dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a problem.
So
13,000 CAFOs in Iowa alone, just for hogs.
Yeah.
And how many? What sort of volume are they producing?
Well, the hog kill in the United States is 400,000 a day.
Wow.
Nyman Ranch, with our network of 600 farmers, is 500 or 5,000, I should say, a week.
That is a significant
difference. So 400,000 a day compared to 5,000 a week. So we are a tiny drop in the bucket.
Right.
And we don't want to discriminate against small farmers. We'll buy as few as 5 pigs from a farmer.
Wow, that's very small. That's impressive.
So, my thinking is, sometimes you have a group, but there's a tail end, a few.
Mm-hmm.
We have Nyman farmers that are high school kids. They're in 4-H or something.
Yeah.
So we want to be inclusive because sometimes that's where your growth comes. You start small and you can work into it. But we have collection points. So, the packing plants in Northwest Iowa, not everybody goes there. You have collection point and you put together semi-loads.
Mm-hmm.
that we have ways of putting those small numbers together.
So you kind of help facilitate the logistics for the farmers to allow to.
It's very complicated, yes, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I used to work in logistics basically for a food startup, and I'm familiar with the difficulties, the challenges.
Yeah, so you got 5,000 head coming from maybe 200 farmers.
And you have to
little groups and everything.
Yeah. You know? What's so important, though, to be able to support smaller farmers? I mean, we live in an era of...
That's the really one of the beautiful things about what Nyman Ranch is. It affords and provides access to market to places like Brooklyn or different parts of the country to these small farmers that don't live next to a big metro area.
Right.
Without this, I don't know how many farmers have told me they certainly wouldn't be raising pigs or cattle, and more than likely they wouldn't be farming at all without Nyman Ranch.
That has to be the best testament ever.
I always feel good about that.
Yeah, that I would too. That's amazing. We have to wrap up in just 1 minute, but basically your stance is in terms of the sustainability to eat meat, to not eat meat, eat meat, eat better meat, eat less meat, eat better meat.
Yeah. Ask questions. How is it raised? Things like that. Mm-hmm. If you're eating meat and you don't know where it comes from, it's probably coming from the commodity system. And if you're buying it, you're supporting that system.
Yeah. It's probably coming from one of those 13,000 farms in Iowa
alone. By the way, those are not owned by farmers for the most part.
Who are they owned by?
They're owned by big companies.
not supporting small farmers on those ones.
No.
One final question. I think there's one final question. Maybe there's two. I've had you on for quite a while, so I'm sure you're ready to go. But like any big policy changes, we live in a very particular time right now, politically speaking. But, you know, is there kind of one or two food and agricultural issue that you would really like to see addressed at the federal level in the next year or so?
Yes.
I'm like, what can the government do for you?
Okay. The Farm Bill, which probably most people don't know anything about at all, but it's a lot of money, mm-hmm. and a lot of subsidies go to farmers. I'm a farmer myself, but the big end of it goes for federal crop insurance.
I just had an episode on that.
Okay, so yes. You know what it is.
And yep.
The farmer pays something, but the majority is paid by
taxpayers.
Taxpayers. Mm-hmm. If I was in charge, mm-hmm. I'm asking myself as a taxpayer, what am I getting out of this? And the answer is nothing. Federal crop insurance or subsidies need to be attached to environmental policies and practices that are going to conserve soil and water. So we need to have something, at least we're going to get some cleaner water or cleaner air out of the deal. And I think that that's important to connect the dots there.
I'm for our listeners, because this is a podcast, I am smiling broadly because I think, yes, I wholeheartedly agree. And that is very refreshing coming from a fourth generation farmer, because
I have another one.
Oh, let's have it. All of them. I could stay here forever.
A lot of agricultural enterprises are exempt from the food and from the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. So one of these CAFOs,
yeah,
they can put out any kind of air they want. Nobody is checking, or water. Nobody's checking.
What?
They're exempt.
Really?
Because they're agricultural. They're getting it's a big loophole.
Wow. I did not know that. I think I should have known that. So you got to close that loophole.
I think it should be closed. And it at least that whole policy should be reexamined.
Right.
There's, for example, when you're combining soybeans, dust comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can do much about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's an organic material and it falls on the ground. But when you have CAFOs that are producing liquid manure and pit gases that are toxic coming out of there all year round, and you've got 13,000 of these, there should be some way of making sure that some of these things are mitigated to a point. If they're spread out there, they have to have cover crops or something, you know. Or,
right, yeah. Yeah,
it needs to be looked at and needs to be done better. And you probably hear a lot of talk about how carbon sequestration and everything, agriculture could be the answer. And we can, a long ways to go on that one.
Yeah. It is a major contributor, agriculture, which I think people don't realize. To greenhouse
gases.
Yeah,
there's over tillage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just came from Iowa this morning, drove to Minneapolis. I saw lots and lots of fields on very hilly that have been plowed up. They're completely bare. There's no cover, no protection at all. So you have wind and water erosion.
Yeah. And, you know, you can't really grow stuff without soil, without healthy soil.
Well, it's a very precious commodity, and we really have to take care of it.
Yes.
We need to have a system that makes soil instead of loses soil.
Doesn't that seem like it makes so much sense?
It does.
Well, that is, I really appreciate you sharing those with us. I think that we should, let's do both of those things. It's a bit of an uphill battle, but I am optimistic if people like you are leading the charge. So we are going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, Paul. This was a real treat.
Well, it's a treat for me to be on, and I always like coming to Brooklyn, you know.
It's pretty cool, right?
Yes, it is.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And I have to, next time you're in town, I would love to have you back on, and we can talk about our lobbying strategy for making some of these changes.
Great.
All right. Thanks. Eating Matters is produced with help from Julia Devin and Jessica Duncan. Our show engineer is Cheat Paul, and music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liu, and thanks for listening. Eating Matters is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.